1989. Budget, $48 million, so slightly less than Superman. Box office, $411.6 million.
I can't believe this movie was made for $48 million.
That's mad. It also set the record of quickest $100 million made for a film in 10 days.
Wow, yeah. That's crazy.
This was something else, mate. This was a cultural phenomenon and a huge success at the cinema. So, let me get down to what led to this film. In the late 1970s, a decade after the success of the 1960s TV show, Batman's popularity was waning. CBS was interested in producing a Batman in Outer Space film. Producers Benjamin Melnicker and Michael E. Uslan purchased the film rights of Batman from DC Comics on October 3rd, 1979. Speaking about this urge to bring a darker Batman to the big screen, Uslan said, "It was like an epiphany. It just hit me. I want to make the definitive, dark, serious version of Batman, the way Bob Kane and Bill Finger had envisioned him in 1939, a creature of the night, stalking criminals in the shadows. And that became it. That became my focal point. If I knew then how long it would have taken me to get that first picture done, I don't know what I would have done."
It's an awful lot of people, Will, who, after the success of this movie, started to talk about how they always knew Batman should be dark and not campy. I knew it in the 70s, but no one listened to me.
Yeah.
And then I'm not sure.
Oh, I was telling you all along, but no one listened to me.
Yeah.
I'm just saying what he's saying. But that's when everything started. I went to see the president of DC Comics, who I believe was Sol Harrison at the time, and I said, "I want to do this." And he looked at me like I was crazy. And Sol had mentored me into the comic book business, and I was very close to him. And he said, "Michael, Batman is as dead as a dodo." And that's a quote, since it went off on TV. He says to me, "No one is interested in Batman. The only interest has been from CBS, who wanted to know if the rights were available because they wanted to do a Batman in Outer Space movie." I said, "Sol, I really believe I can do this." He then advised me to go get credentials, and when I had the credentials, come back and see him. He assured me that in the meantime, no one would take the rights to Batman. Batman in out he goes to space at some point in the comics, I imagine. He goes to,
oh yeah, loads.
We'll probably talk about that later, but man, that would have been crazy. Tom Mankiewicz completed a script titled The Batman in June 1983, focusing on Batman and Dick Grayson's origins, with the Joker and Rupert Thorne as villains and Silver St. Cloud as the romantic interest. The Batman was then announced in late 1983 for a mid-1985 release date on a budget of $20 million. Originally, Mankiewicz had wanted an unknown actor for Batman, William Holden for James Gordon, David Niven as Alfred Pennyworth, and Peter O'Toole as the Penguin, whom Mankiewicz wanted to portray as a mobster with a low body temperature.
We need some iron tablets.
Holden died in 1981 and Niven in 1983, so this would never come to pass.
David Niven looks like Alfred Pennyworth.
Oh, yeah, he's got the classic English gentleman look. I mean,
and the thin moustache.
I swear he was born with it. Anyway, a number of filmmakers were attached to Mankiewicz's script, including Ivan Reitman and Joe Dante. Reitman wanted to cast Bill Murray as Batman and Eddie Murphy as Robin.
I remember hearing that for a while, and I think that was just based on Batman's camp and silly.
Yeah.
Like, who are the cool stars of the moment?
I can't imagine Bill Murray as Batman. It would just be too sardonic. It would be incredibly sardonic.
Yeah, but it would just be a joke thing. Muck tape movie.
Yeah. After the financial success of Pee-wee's Big Adventure in 1985, Warner Brothers hired Tim Burton to direct Batman. Batman had then-girlfriend Julie
Burton, Hicks... not Batman. Batman's
oh, sorry,
not
Burton.
Real.
Burton Batman. Burton had then-girlfriend Julie Hickson write a new 30-page film treatment, thinking the previous script by Mankiewicz was campy. The success of The Dark Knight Returns and the graphic novel Batman the Killing Joke rekindled Warner Brothers' interest in a film adaptation. Burton was initially not a comic book fan, but he was impressed by the dark and serious tone found in both The Dark Knight Returns and The Killing Joke. Burton approached Sam Hamm, a comic book fan. That's Sam Hamm, comic book fan, to write the screenplay. Hamm decided not to use an origin story, feeling the flashbacks would be more suitable and that unlocking the mystery would become part of the storyline. He reasoned, "You totally destroy your credibility if you show the literal process by which Bruce Wayne becomes Batman." Something, of course,
did you hear that?
happened later with Christopher Nolan in Batman
Begins.
Did you
hear that, Nolan? It's also fun because Batman should be this romantic figure.
Yeah.
The idea of a dark and mysterious person is very romantic. If you know right from the get-go what makes him so tortured.
Yeah.
It's like I guess those kind of Twilight, like maybe the first Twilight movie,
yeah,
where the gorgeous, handsome, tortured soul, mysterious tortured soul, like is so very attractive to all the girls reading it and watching it, and you have to discover through the process of the story why is he so tortured and war. You know, it's not just you start, he's a vampire, there he is. You know, you need that kind of the allure, yeah, of the mystery and how can I save him and heal him.
I'll talk about it more, obviously, but going back, it was interesting to see how, you know, compared to like Batman Begins and other origin stuff, origin stories, it was a nice way of telling it. Anyway, Batman was finally given the green light to commence pre-production in April 1988, after the success of Burton's Beetlejuice the same year. When comic book fans found out about Burton directing the film with Michael Keaton starring in the lead role, controversy arose over the tone and direction Batman was going in. Hamm explained, "They hear Tim Burton's name and they think of Pee-wee's Big Adventure. They hear Keaton's name and they think of any number of Michael Keaton comedies. You think the 1960s version of Batman and that was a complete opposite of our film. We tried to market it with a typical dark and serious tone, but the fans didn't believe us." For the role of Batman, a number of A-listers were considered, including Mel Gibson, Kevin Costner, Charlie Sheen, Tom Selleck, Bill Murray, Harrison Ford, and Dennis Quaid. Burton was pressured by Warner Brothers to cast an obvious action movie star and had approached Pierce Brosnan, but he had no interest in playing a comic book character.
Pierce Brosnan would have been great. Although, in 88, what's Brosnan done? It's action-based. He's done a couple of like small action... Has he even done that?
I think they wanted him for Bond around 1987 for Living Daylights.
Oh,
but he was doing Remington Steele. He was doing
Remington Steele, the TV show.
So they went with Timothy Dalton, who I really like, and then later got him for 1995's Goldeneye. But yeah, younger Pierce Brosnan's Batman.
Oh, Pierce Brosnan looks like Bruce Wayne to me.
Yeah, he would have been so suave. Unbelievable. I have a lot of time for Brosnan. I do like him a lot. Actors considered for the role of Joker included Tim Curry, David Bowie, John Lithgow, Brad Dourif, Ray Liotta, and James Woods.
Lithgow. Two of those names are horrifying.
I can see
think
David
of James
Bowie.
Woods and yeah. Ray Liotta as.
Yeah.
You can see David Bowie.
I can see David Bowie looking like the Joker, but not playing him. I can't see David Bowie playing the Joker.
Yeah.
Looking in the makeup and everything, perfect. No. Lithgow, during his audition, attempted to talk Burton out of casting him, a decision he would later publicly regret, stating, "I didn't realise it was such a big deal." John Lithgow as the Joker!
What he means is he didn't realise that Nicholson could have negotiated in such an insane contract, but Lithgow would not have been able to negotiate that contract.
No, he wasn't as big a name at the time, which brings us to very interesting behind-the-scenes stuff, which a lot of people knew about, a lot of people known about for years. Warner Brothers had a clear top choice to play the Joker, of course, with Jack Nicholson. However, Nicholson wasn't thrilled about the project and turned it down. Meanwhile, Robin Williams had been actively campaigning for the Joker role and was eventually offered the part, Warner Brothers basically made the offer to bait Nicholson into signing on after Nicholson was told Williams would take the role if he didn't. Nicholson relented and took the gig. Williams was understandably furious about Warner Brothers' duplicity and demanded an apology from the studio before he would agree to work with them again.
Wow, man.
Of course, this happened a second time as well in 1995 with Batman Forever, with the role of the Riddler.
With Robin Williams again.
Robin Williams again happened again. If you look at I feel sorry for the guy. That's really bad behavior on Warner Brothers' part, but yeah.
Well, it's just a part of negotiating, isn't it? It's insane. And then of course you know the deal that Nicholson got?
I heard it was a huge amount of money. Also and rights and merchandising rights and stuff like that.
It's not merchandising, but he got money he got a percentage of the gross.
Ooh.
So whatever it takes in totally, he got, and it's something in they estimate it's something in the region of like 80. It's something between $50 and $90 million that he got at a time when that was not, you know, going to happen.
After agency fees, that's still insane.
Yeah, so it was something like $6 million. $6 million actual fee, but a percentage of the take. Yeah,
incredible. Burton chose Billy Dee Williams as Harvey Dent because he wanted to include the villain Two-Face in a future film using the concept of an African-American Two-Face for the black and white concept. However, Two-Face was later recast with Tommy Lee Jones in the 1995 film Batman Forever. Speaking about the role of Dent, Williams said, "The contract I signed was to play Harvey Dent. It wasn't a 2 or 3 picture situation. With Star Wars, I signed for 2 pictures. I think that at that stage, after the first Batman, some Japanese company, Sony or something like that, bought out the contract. I can't really recall it. Tommy Lee Jones is a great actor, and it was a different regime then. When I took on the role, I was looking forward to play Two-Face, but it didn't work out." Did you see him? I love that in Lego Batman where they actually got him in to play Two-Face.
They did, yeah.
They did, and fun. I was in the cinema grinning and went, that is such... Mwah, that's the right kind of fan service.
I'm not entirely sure what a black and white Two-Face would look like. Well, presumably they mean half of him would be kind of like a whitened thing. I'm not sure about that.
Well, I'll probably go mention it later, but they recently finished a run, DC Comics released a run called Batman 89, which served as an unofficial third story, where Billy Dee Williams, Harvey Dent, does become Two-Face, and he basically has a very Beetlejuice look. Like, he has the black and white suit, and he has half his face is sort of very, very, very pale blue. It's a really good read. It's just really mad to go back and see Michael Keaton's face in a comic like that with graying at the sides and stuff. It's really good. Production designer Anton Furst was hired for the film, who then worked to clash architectural styles to make Gotham City the ugliest and bleakest metropolis imaginable. Furst said,
Metropolis.
What happened there? I'm
you were going to say metropolitan, and metropolitan, then you realised the word ended halfway through.
Yeah. First said, "We imagined what New York City might have become without a planning commission. A city run by crime, with a riot of architectural styles. An essay in ugliness, as if hell erupted through the pavement and kept on going."
I love Anton First so much.
What else has he done? Because...
Well, he was on board for... Well, it took them a long time to get him on this project. Mm. And he was such a first choice for them that it was a really big deal that they was able to get him to come aboard. But he's not... I mean, he did Full Metal Jacket. He did... Did he do Beetlejuice?
It says here, Burton tried to convince Furst to work on Beetlejuice, but decided to do High Spirits instead.
Oh, yeah. And then, of course, he does Batman Returns, which I think Gotham looks way better.
Yeah.
Like, he's got full reign in Batman Returns.
Oh, dear. I just read that he committed suicide.
We don't need to mention it on the podcast, do we? We just keep it light, can't we?
I'm sorry.
I mean, we talk about lots of famous people. We don't immediately go to how they died.
No, I just had a quick look at his Wikipedia page.
Yeah, you just keep it in your head, don't you? And don't.
No, but it was during Batman Returns, and that's like, oh dear. That's
okay, but we. St-
Let's talk about happy things. Let's talk about... Costume designer Bob Ringwood turned down the chance to work on a Bond on the Bond film License to Kill in favour of Batman. Ringwood found it difficult designing the Batsuit because the image of Batman in the comics is the huge, big, 6'4" hunk with a dimpled chin. Michael Keaton is a guy with average build.
I don't know what comics he's read, but that's not Batman.
Who's the guy we keep making fun of in Marvel Comics for built? Rob Leash.
What's Which he talking about?
The artist who baked that Captain America with the huge chest.
Rob Liefeld,
that was it. Yeah, has he been reading it? Yeah, did Rob Liefeld do a Batman?
He's describing Superman, which Batman doesn't really look like.
Yeah, exactly. Ringwood stated that the problem was to make somebody who was average size and ordinary looking into this bigger than life creature.
So me and you probably, I can't, because even though I was how many years older than you, you're so young, you don't have any... You're not going into this movie going, well, who are they going to get to play Batman? I'm not sure about that idea. There's none of that going on whatsoever, is there? It is... Michael Keaton was Batman, and he looked fantastic. The costume looked fantastic. So it's kind of hard to for me and you to put ourselves back into a time and place where it's odd to think that he would be able to kind of pull this off, or people were doubting it, because it just... looks so right to me.
Yeah, it's mad. But I if we had the same level of like media coverage back then as we do now with fan speculation,
it'd be awful. It'd be awful.
Yeah, it would have been absolutely toxic back then. Burton hired Danny Elfman of the new wave band Oingo Boingo to compose the music score. Elfman was Burton's collaborator on Pee-wee's Big Adventure and Beetlejuice. Talking with The Hollywood Reporter years later, Elfman revealed how he had no choice but to write the film score from an airplane bathroom. That hit me at the worst possible time. On the way home, the inspiration hits me, and it was like, what do I do? I'm on a 747. How do I do this? I'm going to forget this all. I'm going to land, and they're going to play some Beatles song, and I'm going to forget everything. I start running in the bathroom and hum phrases, and I go back to my seat, and I'm thinking. 10 minutes later, back in the bathroom, and then back to my seat, and then back to the bathroom, because I couldn't do this with the guy sitting next to me. 10 minutes later, I am back in the bathroom, and I open the door, and this time there are 3 flight attendants, and they're probably going, what the hell is he doing so frequently? You can't do that much blow. You can't shoot up that often. What is he doing in there? Mad, have you ever listened to the band Oingo Boingo?
Yeah, probably. I did enjoy a lot of New Wave as a younger man, so probably, but I don't recall much.
Oh, they're really good. The thing is, they're one of those bands that never really took foot here, but any American listeners will vouch for me that they were much bigger over there. But I've listened to a fair bit of them. I really love them. They're very bizarre and a lot of fun. There's some really good songs. Producers John Peters and Peter Guber wanted Prince to write music for The Joker and Michael Jackson to do the romance songs. Elfman would then combine the style of Prince and Jackson songs together for the entire film score. At the encouragement of Prince's then manager, Albert Magnoli, it was also agreed that Prince himself would write and sing the film's songs. Now, we're going to get onto a bit more about Prince here. We'll talk about Prince's soundtrack later. Speaking about Prince's... our opinions on it, I mean. Speaking about Prince's experience writing songs for the film, Prince's manager, Albert Magnoli, said, when he did Purple Rain and the tour, he had spent a tremendous amount of cash and he was now at a place where his management, to their credit, were attempting to leverage future earnings in order to pay for past and present debt. I immediately did a forensic kind of financial search as to what was really going on, and it was more horrible than anybody thought. So, the plan was about trying to bring revenue into operation without overextending him to the point where no one would be interested in getting involved in anything he wanted to do. And the Batman album came into being when I was contacted by Batman producer Mark Canton, and I went to Prince and said, this will help us bring revenue into the system without having to expose you to another album. This will be a way for you to creatively go to work. It's not essentially a Prince album, it's a Batman album, and so it's a win-win. The revenue from Batman and severe cost-cutting, we went from a 10 million per year nut to 2 million, allowing him to continue on without a concern, without changing his lifestyle.
So, yeah, you can kind of understand when they're talking about not overextending yourself, it means you need to bring in a lot of money.
Yeah.
Your options are make lots of albums. Well, that just floods the market and people get sick and tired of you.
Yep.
So you need to kind of protect yourself, especially when you are a star like Prince.
I mean,
that's keeping the a little bit of mystique going.
I mean, I love Prince. I think he was insanely talented. He was one of those people who would just spend all his time in the studio. That he was a prolific guy. He would just, and he'd write songs for other people too. He's got his head in the right place in terms of that.
You ever heard Kevin Smith talk about Prince's house?
No. What did he say?
On one of his wonderful speaking tours, he talked about working with Prince for some reason. And Prince just had, like, every room in Prince's house was wired for sound and recording all the time. So wherever he was, if he had an idea for a song, he would just start singing out loud and it would be recorded. And so he'd know the next day, oh, I was in the bathroom at 10 and I sang that ditty. I'll go and listen back to it.
I was about to say, at first it sounded like Richard Nixon's house. With loads of wiretapping. Speaking about Prince writing music for the film, Mark Canton, then head of production at Marvel, at Warner Brothers, said, "Prince, to me, was the greatest. We tried to bring Michael Jackson in to do it together with him, but that was never real. The way executives worked in those days with talent was to not only make a movie an event, but to market it. A lot of it was, how do we get the most bang for our buck? How do we get people to pay attention? We did it with Purple Rain brilliantly. Prince loved Batman. He talked about Batman. The Batman series as a kid was something that he loved. I think he loved the darkness and the intensity."
Yeah, so it's not just about getting a good singer to do some good songs.
Yeah.
When you get someone like Prince in,
yes,
then the PR behind that, it's another level of marketing on for the movie.
It's like a completely different arm on itself. It's so fascinating, because you think about this film and then realize, oh yeah, Prince did a whole bloody separate soundtrack for this film that was, you know, amazing. In the months before Batman's release in June 1989, a popular culture phenomena known as Batmania began. Over $750 million worth of merchandise was sold. Cult filmmaker and comic book writer Kevin Smith remembered, "That summer was huge. You couldn't turn around without seeing the bat signal somewhere. People were cutting it into their effing heads. It was just the summer of Batman, and if you were a comic book fan, it was pretty hot."
That's the thing that I wanted to talk about. I've not talked about this in a while, but when you're a kid, before, in the 1980s, we talked about there aren't a lot of comic book things in movies, there aren't a lot of comic book TV shows, especially in England, where comic books are not as, American superhero comics are not as popular. There's the Beano and the Dandy and things like that, but superhero stuff is just not a popular thing in the 80s. To then see the bat logo, when Kevin Smith says it was over, it was, I remember this, it was bus stops, and it was just the posters for this, it was the first time I'd ever sort of come across what would be the teaser poster. There was no information on this poster. There was just the bat symbol. It wasn't even the word Batman on it, right? And that's how they talk about things that pass from just being, you know, logos that become a part of like pop culture hugely. One of the most recognizable symbols in the world was, and it became more and so because of this marketing campaign. And so the symbol was just everywhere, and it was getting you just like invested and interested. And then the other posters came out, and then the marketing, like the merchandise, hit before the movie came out. It was just everywhere, and that was something that, for me, someone that cherished these moments where I would see my favorite characters in the outside world. Like, I can remember there being a Captain America and the Avengers arcade game at the leisure center and going, wow, my favorite characters are kind of like out in the other kids are seeing them, because I knew nobody that read comic books at all. And so seeing the bat symbol plastered on bus stops and billboards, and you know, I live right down right on the corner where I lived, there was big advert billboards in the town, right at the crossing there, and I have such strong memories of the Batman logo being there. And it's so weird, but just like getting to pass it every day on the way to school. I loved it. I wanted to walk that way to school, which took slightly longer because I wanted to walk past the Batman logo every day. Madness.
I get it. I just remember how that symbol was my childhood. That's all I remember.
There's talk of how they repeated it.
Hmm.
Certainly the black and gold.
Yeah.
But the repeating of the symbol. So in the lead up to Jurassic Park being released, all they released initially was the Jurassic Park logo, the symbol. Not the word Jurassic Park, not anything about the movie. And again, it was black and gold. There's another movie they did it for, I can't quite remember, but there's a few of them where this started to be the thing of that Dick Tracy. That's the other one. Now, obviously, Dick Tracy didn't turn out to work, but I was really invested.
You'd say.
Like, it was like that logo. There's a logo, and it was the guy on the watch, on the talkie watch.
Funny thing that I remember watching Dick Tracy cartoons around the same time. And then the film came out, and you know, I barely remember the film, but apparently Warren Beatty still dresses up as Dick Tracy and demands they do another film or something. It says that if you look online,
what do you mean? What, he runs into a movie producer's house? And
no, I think he records videos on the internet and stuff. Randomly.
I have heard he's been trying to get one going for a while.
Yeah, and I saw a video recently. You know, he's looking a lot older, obviously, and he's still got the big yellow raincoat on and everything. And I'm just thinking, oh man, I think you have to move on, mate. You know, I don't think we're ever gonna get another Dick Tracy, because it's like we're never gonna get another Doc Savage. Because we'll
get a Doc Savage. Yeah,
you reckon we'll get a Doc Savage?
Yeah. Look, Hollywood has nothing, Will. They have nothing. You don't think we're going to get a Doc Savage shared universe?
The Doc Savage.
Of course
shared.
We are.
What? But not Dick Tracy again. No more Dick Tracy. Do you think?
No. We'll get a version of everything.
Okay. I'll be interested with Dick Tracy, because it will just look like, oh, look, he's got a wrist-mounted communication device. It's like, yeah, we all have that.
I desperately wanted one of those as a kid.
Same. I love that so much.
We don't have it, though, do we? We don't have a wrist-mounted TV screen that shows you. You can video call someone from your watch, and they've got their own watch that would video call them.
Okay. I could probably do that. We got the technology, Rob.
We don't do it, though.
We don't, because there's no point. Anyway, Anton First and Peter Young won the Academy Award for Best Art Direction, while Nicholson was nominated for the Golden Globe Award for Best Actor in Musical or a Comedy. The success of Batman and Batman Returns prompted Warner Brothers Animation to create the acclaimed Batman the Animated Series as a result of the beginning of the long-running DC animated universe and helping establish the modern-day superhero film genre. Looking back on Batman paving the way for modern superhero movies, Burton joked, "Ever since I did Batman, it was like the first dark comic book movie. Now everybody wants to do a dark and serious superhero movie. I guess I'm the one responsible for that trend."
Thanks for joining us as we revisit some of our favourite moments from Marvel vs. Marvel. Don't forget, our full-length episodes are jam-packed with hours of Marvel trivia, behind the page, behind the scenes, and comic book Marvel history.